age 30, coat and tie, at least from the shoulders up. Name's Gavin Mead. 4 years now at Skelly and Pershing. Litigation. One of about 30 associates toiling away on the case of Trilon versus Barton. In the normal course of things, you'd probably meet him in a few weeks, but Mr. Mead is about to be sacked. Kyle was holding the sheet of paper, looking into the handsome face of Gavin Mead, and wondering what sin he'd committed. Seems he, too, has a little problem from the past, Benny was saying, relishing the role of executioner. Seems he, too, liked to get rough with the girls. Not rape, though. I didn't rape anybody, and you know it. Maybe not. Got another video, Benny? Been crawling through the gutter again, looking for someone else to ruin? Nope, no video. Just some affidavits. Mr. Mead doesn't rape women. He just beats them. In college, 10 years ago, he had a girlfriend who had a problem with bruises. One night, he put her in the hospital. The police were finally invited in. Things unraveled for Mr. Mead. He was arrested, jailed, formally charged, and facing trial. Then there was a settlement. Money changed hands. The girl wanted no part of a trial, and everything was dropped. Mead walked away. But he's got this record now. No problem, he just lied about it. When he applied to law school at Michigan, he lied on his application. When he went through the background check at Skelly, he lied again. Automatic termination. I'm so happy for you, Benny. I know how much these little stories mean to you. Go get him. Ruin him. Attaboy. Everybody has secrets, Kyle. I can ruin anyone. You're the man. Kyle slammed the door and left the hotel. At noon on Saturday, three charter buses pulled away from the Skelly and Pershing office building and left the city. They carried all 103 members of the first-year associate class. On board each bus was a full bar and plenty of snacks, and the drinking was fast and serious. 3 hours later, they arrived at a yacht club in the Hamptons. The first party was under a tent near Montauk Beach. Dinner was under another tent on the hotel grounds. The second and last party was at the mansion of one of the Skelly descendants. A reggae band played by the pool. The retreat was designed to break the ice and make the recruits happy they'd come on board. Many of the firm's partners were there, and they got as drunk as the associates. The night went long, and the morning was not pleasant. After an early brunch with gallons of coffee, they settled in a small ballroom to listen to the wise old men offer their secrets to a successful career. Several retired partners, legends at the firm, told war stories and cracked jokes and offered advice. The floor was open, and any question could be asked. After the old goats were gone, a very diverse panel went to the front and continued with the storytelling. A black man, a white woman, a Hispanic, and a Korean, all partners, talked about the firm's commitment to tolerance and equal rights and so on. Later in the day, they ate shrimp and oysters on a private beach. Then the buses were reloaded and headed back to Manhattan. They arrived after dark, and the weary young lawyers headed home for a short night. For them, the concept of exhaustion was about to be redefined. Chapter 16. Any hope of pursuing meaningful work was promptly crushed at 7:30 Monday morning when all 12 new litigation associates were sent into the abyss of document review. As far back as the first year of law school, Kyle had heard horror stories of bright and eager young associates being marched into some dreary basement, chained to a desk, and given a mountain of densely worded documents to read. And while he'd known that his first year would include a generous dose of this punishment, he simply wasn't prepared for it. He and Dale, who was looking better by the day but showing no signs of a personality, were assigned to a case involving a client that was being hammered in the financial press. Their new boss for the day, a senior associate named Carlene, called them into her office and explained things. For the next few days, they would review some crucial documents, billing at least 8 hours a day at $300 an hour. That would be their rate until the bar results were made known in November, and assuming they passed, their hourly rate would jump to $400. There was no thought given to a quick word about what might happen if they did not pass the bar exam. Scully and Pershing Associates posted a pass rate of 92% the previous year, and it was simply assumed that everyone had passed. 8 hours was the minimum, at least for now, and with lunch and coffee thrown in, that meant, roughly, a 10-hour day. Start no later than 8 a.m., and nobody ever thought about leaving before 7 p.m. In case they were curious, Carlene billed 2,400 hours last year. She had been with the firm for 5 years and acted as though she were a lifer, a future partner. Kyle glanced around her well-appointed office and noticed a diploma from Columbia Law School. There was a photo of a younger Carlene on a horse, but none of her with a husband, boyfriend, or children. She was explaining that there was a chance that a partner might need Kyle or Dale for a quick project, so be prepared. Document review was certainly not glamorous, but it was the safety net for all new associates. You can always go there and find work that can be billed, Carlene said. 8 hours minimum, but there is no max. How delightful, thought Kyle. If for some reason 10 hours a day were not enough, the door to document review was always wide open for more. Their first case involved a client with the slightly ludicrous name of Placid Mortgage. Ludicrous in Kyle's opinion, but he kept his mouth shut as Carlene rattled off the more salient facts of the case. Starting in 2001, when a new wave of government regulators took over and adopted a less intrusive attitude, Placid and other huge home mortgage companies became aggressive in their pursuit of new loans. They advertised heavily, especially on the internet, and convinced millions of lower and middle-class Americans that they could indeed afford to buy homes that they actually could not afford. The bait was the old adjustable-rate mortgage, and in the hands of crooks like Placid, it was adjusted in ways never before imagined. Placid sucked them in, went light on the paperwork, collected nice fees up front, then sold the crap in the secondary markets. The company was not holding the paper when the overheated real estate market finally crashed, home values plummeted, and foreclosures became rampant. Carlene used much softer language in her summary, but Kyle had known for some time that his firm was representing Placid. He'd read a dozen stories about the mortgage meltdown and seen the name Scully and Pershing mentioned often, always in defense of Placid's latest setback. Now the lawyers were trying to clean up the mess. Placid had been battered by lawsuits, but the worst one was a class action involving 35,000 of its former borrowers. It had been filed in New York a year earlier. Carlene led them to a long, dungeon-like room with no windows, a concrete floor, poor lighting, and neat stacks of white cardboard boxes with the words Placid Mortgage stamped on the end. It was the mountain Kyle had heard so much about. The boxes, as Carlene explained, contained the files of all 35,000 plaintiffs. Each file had to be reviewed. "You're not alone," Carlene said with a fake laugh, just as both Kyle and Dale were about to resign. "We have other associates and even some paralegals on this review." She opened a box, pulled out a file about an inch thick, and went through a quick summary of what the litigation team was looking for. "Someday in court," she said gravely, "it will be crucial for our litigators to be able to tell the judge that we have examined every document in this case." Kyle assumed it was also crucial for the firm to have clients who could pay through the nose for such useless work. He was suddenly dizzy with the realization that in just a few short minutes he would punch in and begin charging $300 an hour for his time. He was worth nothing close to that. He wasn't even a lawyer. Carlene left them there, her heels clicking on the polished concrete as she hustled out of the room. Kyle gawked at the boxes, then at Dale, who looked as stunned as he did. "You gotta be kidding," he said. But Dale was determined to prove something, so she grabbed a box, dropped it on the table, and yanked out some files. Kyle walked to the other end of the room, as far away as possible, and found himself some files. He opened one and glanced at his watch. It was 7:50. Scully lawyers billed by tenths. A tenth of an hour is 6 minutes, 2/10 is 12, and so on. 1.6 hours is an hour and 36 minutes. Should he roll back the clock 2 minutes to 7:48 and therefore be able to bill 2/10 before the hour of 8? Or should he stretch his arms, take a sip of coffee, get more situated, and wait until 7:54 to begin his first billable minute as a lawyer? It was a no-brainer. This was Wall Street, where everything was done with aggression. When in doubt, bill aggressively. If not, the next guy will, and then you won't catch him. It took an hour to read every word in the file. 1.2 hours, to be exact. And suddenly he had no reluctance in billing Placid for 1.2 hours, or $360 for the review. Not long ago, say about 90 minutes, he found it hard to believe he was worth $300 an hour. He hadn't even passed the bar. Now, though, he had been converted. Placid owed him the money because their sleaze had gotten them sued. Someone had to plow through their debris. He would aggressively bill the company out of revenge. Down the table, Dale worked diligently without any distraction. Somewhere in the midst of the third file, Kyle paused long enough to ponder a few things. Still on the clock, he wondered where the Trilon Barton room was. Where were the highly classified documents, and how were they protected? What kind of vault were they stored in? This dungeon appeared to be security-free, but then who would spend money to protect a bunch of mortgage files gone bad? If Placid had dirty laundry, you could bet it wasn't buried where Kyle might find it. He thought about his life. Here, in the third hour of his professional career, he was already questioning his sanity. What manner of man could sit here and pore over these meaningless pages for hours and days without going bonkers? What did he expect the life of a first-year associate to be? Would it be any better at another firm? Dale left for 10 minutes and returned. Probably a bathroom break. He bet she kept the meter running. Lunch was in the firm cafeteria on the 43rd floor. Much had been made about the high quality of the food. Great chefs consulted, the freshest ingredients used, a dazzling menu of light dishes, and so on. They were free to leave the building and go to a restaurant, but few associates dared. The firm's policies were prominently published and distributed, but there were many unwritten rules. One was that the rookies ate in-house, unless a client could be billed for a real lunch. Many of the partners used the cafeteria as well. It was important for them to be seen by their underlings, and to brag about the great food, and, most important, to eat in 30 minutes as an example of efficiency. The decor was Art Deco and nicely done, but the ambiance was still reminiscent of a prison mess hall. There was a clock on every wall, and you could almost hear them ticking. Kyle and Dale joined Tim Reynolds at a small table near a vast window with a spectacular view of other tall buildings. Tim appeared to be shell-shocked, glazed eyes, vapid stare, weak voice. They swapped stories of the horrors of document review and began joking about their departures from the legal profession. The food was good, though lunch was not about eating. Lunch was now an excuse to get away from the documents. But it didn't last long. They agreed to meet after work for a drink, Dale's first sign of life, then headed back to their respective dungeons. 2 hours later, Kyle was hallucinating and flashing back to the glory days at Yale when he edited the prestigious law journal from his own office and managed dozens of other very bright students. His long hours led to a product, an important journal that was published 8 times a year and read widely by lawyers and judges and scholars. His name was first on the masthead as editor-in-chief. Few students were so honored with such a title. For 1 year, he was the man. How had he fallen so fast and so hard? "It's just part of the boot camp," he kept telling himself. "Basic training." But what a waste! Placid, its shareholders, its creditors, and probably the American taxpayers would get stuck with the legal fees, fees being racked up in part by the now half-hearted efforts of one Kyle McAvoy, who, after reviewing 9 of the 35,000 files, was convinced that his firm's client should be locked away in prison. The CEO, the managers, the board of directors, all of them. You can't jail a corporation, but an exception should be made for every employee who ever worked at Placid Mortgage. What would John McAvoy think if he could see his son? Kyle laughed and shuddered at the thought. The verbal abuse would be funny and cruel. And at that moment, Kyle would accept it without firing back. At that moment, his father was either in his office counseling a client through a problem, or in a courtroom mixing it up with another lawyer. Regardless, he was with real people, in real conversations. And life was anything but dull. Dale was seated 50 feet away with her back to him. It was a nice back, as far as he could tell, trim and curvy. He could see nothing else at the moment, but had already examined the other parts. Slim legs, narrow waist, not much of a chest, but then you can't have everything. What would happen, he reckoned, if, 1, he slowly, over the next few days and weeks, put the move on her, 2, he was successful, and 3, he made sure they got caught. He'd be bounced from the firm, which at that moment seemed like a great idea. What would Benny say about that? An ugly, involuntary dismissal from Scully and Pershing. Every young man has the right to chase women, and if you get caught, well, so what? At least you got fired for something worthwhile. Benny would lose his spy. His spy would get the boot without getting disbarred. Interesting. Of course, with his luck, there would probably be another video, this one of Kyle and Dale, and Benny would get his dirty hands on it, and, well, who knows. Kyle mulled these things over at $300 an hour. He didn't think about turning off the meter, because he wanted Placid to bleed. He had learned that Dale earned a PhD in mathematics at the age of 25, from MIT, no less, and that she had taught for a few years before deciding that the classroom was boring. She studied law at Cornell. Why she thought she could make the transition from the classroom to the courtroom was not clear, at least not to Kyle. Right now, a class of struggling geometry students would seem like a parade. She was 30 years old, never married, and he had just begun the task of trying to unravel her withdrawn and complicated personality. He stood to go for a walk, something to get the blood pumping into his stultified brain. "You want some coffee?" he asked Dale. "No, thanks," she said, and actually smiled. 2 cups of strong coffee did little to stimulate his mind, and by late afternoon, Kyle began to worry about permanent brain damage. To be on the safe side, he and Dale decided to wait until 7 p.m. before checking out. They left together, rode the elevator down without a word, both thinking the same thought. They were violating another of the unwritten rules by leaving so early. But they shook it off and walked 4 blocks to an Irish pub, where Tim Reynolds had secured a booth and was almost finished with his first pint. He was with Everett, a first year from NYU who'd been assigned to the commercial real estate practice group. After they sat down and got themselves situated, they pulled out their firm phones. All 4 were on the table, much like loaded guns. Dale ordered a martini. Kyle ordered a club soda. And when the waiter disappeared, Tim said, "You don't drink?" "No, I had to quit in college." It was Kyle's standard line, and he knew all of the follow-ups it would provoke.
"You had to quit?"
"Yep, I was drinking too much, so I quit."
"Rehab? AA? All that stuff?"
Everett asked. "No, I saw a counselor, and he convinced me that the drinking would only get worse. I went cold turkey and have never looked back."
"That's awesome," Tim said as he drained the pint of ale.
"I don't drink either," Dale said. "But after today, I'm hitting the bottle." From someone with absolutely no sense of humor, this declaration was quite funny. After a good laugh, they settled into a rehash of their first day. Tim had billed 8.6 hours reading the legislative history of an old New York law aimed at discouraging class action lawsuits. Everett had billed 9 hours reading leases. But Kyle and Dale won the game with their description of the dungeon and its 35,000 files. When their drinks arrived, they toasted Placid Mortgage and the 400,000 foreclosures it had precipitated. They toasted Tabor, who had vowed to stay at his desk until midnight. They toasted Scully and Pershing and its wonderful beginning salaries. Halfway through the martini, the gin hit Dale's mushy brain, and she began giggling. When she ordered a second,
Kyle excused himself and walked home.
At 5:30 on Tuesday, Kyle was wrapping up his second day in the dungeon and mentally drafting his letter of resignation. He would happily tell Benny to go to hell, and he would happily face Elaine and her rape claim in a courtroom in Pittsburgh. Anything would be better than what he was enduring. He had survived the day by continually repeating the mantra, "But they're paying me $200,000 a year." But by 5:30, he didn't care what they were paying him. His firm phone pinged with an email from Doug Peckham, and it read, "Kyle, need some help. My office. Now, if possible." He forgot his letter of resignation, jumped to his feet, and bolted for the door. To Dale, he said as he dashed by, "Gonna run see Doug Peckham, a litigation partner. He's got a project." If this sounded cruel, then so be it. If it was boasting, he didn't care. She looked shocked and wounded, but he left her there, all alone in the placid dungeon. He ran down two flights of stairs and was out of breath when he walked through Peckham's open door. The partner was on the phone, standing, fidgeting, and he waved Kyle into a fine leather chair across from his desk. When he signed off with a, "You're a moron, Slade, a true moron," he looked at Kyle, forced a smile, and said, "So how's it going so far?" "Document review." Nothing else needed to be said. "Sorry about that, but we all suffered through it. Look, I need a hand here. You up to it?" Peckham fell violently into his chair and began rocking, thrusting himself back and forth without taking his eyes off Kyle. "Anything. Right now I'll shine your shoes." "They're shined. Got a case here in the Southern District of New York, a big one. We're defending Barks in a class action filed by some folks who took their heartworm pills and eventually croaked. Big, messy, complicated case that's raging in a number of states. We go before Judge Cafferty on Thursday morning. You know him?"
"I've been here 2 days," Kyle almost blurted. "I don't know anybody."
"No. Caffeine Cafferty. He's got some chemical imbalance that keeps him up all night and all day, and when he's off his meds, he calls up lawyers and screams at them because the cases are moving so slowly. When he's on his meds, he yells too, but doesn't swear as much. Anyway, his schedule is called the Rocket Docket because he moves things along. Good judge, but a real pain in the ass. Anyway, this case has dragged on, and now he's threatening to send it to another jurisdiction." Kyle was scribbling notes as fast as possible. At the first break in the narrative, he said, "Heartworms? Actually, it's a drug that eats away plaque in the major blood vessels, including the left and right ventricles. From a medical point of view, it's complicated and nothing you should worry about. We have two partners with medical degrees handling that aspect of the case. 4 partners total, as well as 10 associates. I'm lead counsel." He said this with far too much smugness. Then he jumped to his feet and lumbered over to the window for a quick look at the city. His white starched shirt was oversized and did a nice job of hiding his bulbous physique. Benny's summary had been typically to the point. Peckham's first marriage broke up 13 months after he joined Scully and Pershing, fresh out of Yale. His current wife was a lawyer who was a partner in a firm down the street. She too worked long hours. They were 2 small children. Their apartment on the Upper West Side was appraised for $3.5 million, and they owned the obligatory house in the Hamptons. Last year, Doug earned $1.3 million. His wife, $1.2 million. He was regarded as a top litigator whose specialty was defending big pharmaceuticals, though he rarely went to trial. 6 years earlier, he was on the losing end of a major case involving a painkiller that caused suicides, at least in the opinion of the jury. Scully and Pershing sent him to a spa in Italy for a 2-week treatment. "Cafferty wants to get rid of the case," he said, stretching a sore back. "We, of course, will fight that. But truthfully, I would rather see it in another jurisdiction. There are 4 possibilities: Duval County, Florida, downtown Memphis, a rural county in Nebraska called Fillmore, or Des Plaines, Illinois. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to research these 4 jurisdictions." He fell into his chair again and began rocking. "I need to know what juries do there. What are the verdicts? How do big companies fare in these places? Now, there are several jury research outfits that sell their data, and we subscribe to all of it, but it's not always accurate. Lots of numbers, but not a lot of useful info. You gotta dig and dig. You gotta call lawyers in these 4 places and find the dirt. Are you in, Kyle?" As if he had a choice.
Sure, sounds great. I wouldn't call it great. I need this by 7:30 Thursday morning. Have you pulled an all-nighter yet? No, I've only been here for... Right. Well, get to work. Memo form, but nothing fancy. We'll meet here at 7:30 on Thursday with two other associates. You'll have 10 minutes to do your summary. Anything else? Not right now. I'll be here until 10 tonight, so zip me a note if you need something. Thanks, and thanks for getting me out of document review. What a waste. The desk phone was ringing as Kyle hustled out of the office. He went straight to the cube, grabbed his laptop, and raced off to the firm's cavernous main library on the 39th floor. There were at least four smaller libraries scattered throughout, but Kyle had yet to find them. He could not remember being so excited over a research project. It was a real case, with deadlines and an angry judge and strategic decisions in the air. The memo he was about to prepare would be read and relied on by real lawyers in the heat of battle. Kyle almost felt sorry for the poor rookies left behind in document review, but he knew he'd be back there soon enough. He forgot dinner until almost 10 p.m., when he ate a cold sandwich from a machine while reading jury research. With no sleeping bag at hand, he left the library at midnight. There were at least 20 associates still there, and took a cab to his apartment. He slept 4 hours, then made the 30-minute walk back to Broad Street in only 22 minutes. He was not about to start gaining weight. The firm's private gym on the 40th floor was a joke because it was eternally empty. A few of the secretaries used it during lunch, but no lawyer would be caught dead there. His meter began promptly at 5 a.m. By 9, he was calling trial lawyers and defense lawyers in Duval County, Florida, in and around Jacksonville. He had a long list of cases that had gone to trial, and he planned to talk to every lawyer he could get on the phone. The more calls he made, the longer the list became. Lawyers in Florida, Memphis, and Western Tennessee, Lincoln and Omaha, and dozens in the Chicago area. He found more cases and more trials and called more lawyers. He tracked every Barks trial in the past 20 years and compared their verdicts. There was no word from Doug Peckham, no text message or email on the firm phone always lying on the table next to the legal pad. Kyle was delighted to be given such free rein, such discretion. Dale sent an email and asked about lunch. He met her in the cafeteria for a quick salad at 1 p.m. She was still imprisoned in the Placid Tomb, but mercifully, three other rookies had been sent in to help with the grunt work. All three were thinking about quitting. She seemed genuinely pleased that someone she knew had been given a real task. "Save me some Placid files," Kyle said as they left the cafeteria. "I'll be back tomorrow." He left the library at midnight on Wednesday, after billing Barks for 18 hours, 6 the day before. He added 2 more early Thursday morning as he polished up the 15-page memo and rehearsed his 10-minute presentation to Peckham and a team of senior associates. At precisely 7:30, he approached the partner's door and saw that it was closed. "He's expecting me at 7:30, he said politely to a secretary. "I'll let him know," she said without making a move toward the phone. 5 minutes passed as Kyle tried to settle his nerves and appear calm. He had a knot in his stomach, and there was sweat around his collar. Why? He kept asking himself. It's just a brief presentation before a friendly audience. We're on the same team, right? 10 minutes. 15. He could hear voices in Peckham's office. Finally, the door was opened by one of the associates, and Kyle walked in. Peckham appeared surprised to see him. "Oh, yes, Kyle, I forgot," he said, snapping his fingers and frowning. "I should have emailed. The hearing's been postponed. You're off the hook. Keep the memo, I might need it later." Kyle's mouth fell open, and he glanced around. Two associates were huddled over a small work table, papers everywhere, and two more were seated near the desk. All four seemed to be amused. The false deadline. Kyle, of course, had heard of this little maneuver. The hapless associate is run through the grinder to produce a useless memo or brief that is time-sensitive but will never be used. But the client will nonetheless get billed and will pay, so even though the research is not needed, it is at least profitable. Kyle had heard of the false deadline, but didn't see this one coming. Sure, no problem, he said, backtracking. Thanks, Peckham said as he flipped the page of another document. See you later. Sure. Kyle was at the door when Peckham asked, "Say, Kyle, where's the best place for Barks to try the case?"
"Nebraska, Fillmore County," Kyle said eagerly.
Two of the associates laughed out loud, and the other two were highly entertained. One of them said,
"Nebraska? No one tries cases in Nebraska."
"Thanks, Kyle," Peckham said, patronizing.
"Nice work.
And please get out of here." For $200,000 a year, plus treats, the job would naturally have its moments of humiliation.
"You're getting paid for this," Kyle kept repeating as he slowly made his way up the stairs.
"Take it in stride. Be tough. Happens to everyone." Back in the dungeon, he managed to smile. When Dale asked, "How did it go?" he said, "It's hard to say." At the far end of the room, two associates were plowing through mortgage files. Kyle nodded at them, then parked himself near Dale, arranged his pen, legal pad, and firm phone. He opened a box, removed a file, and re-entered the world of Placid Mortgage. It was known territory, and he felt oddly safe there. He would not be harmed or humiliated. A long career as a document reviewer would no doubt be dull, but it would also be much less hazardous than that of a litigator.
Chapter 17. When Kyle left the office late Friday afternoon, he considered his first week to be a success, though a dismal one. He billed Placid 30 hours and Barks Biomed 26, and though virtually all of this valuable time would eventually mean little to either client, he wasn't paid to worry about such things. He was there to do one thing, bill. If he kept up the pace and managed only 50 hours a week, he would hit $2,500 for the year, a high number for a first year and one that would catch the attention of the higher-ups. For the week, Tabor the Gunner billed 50 hours, Dale 44, Tim Reynolds 43. It was amazing how consumed they were with the clock after only 5 days on the job. He walked to his apartment, changed into jeans, stuffed a phone in each pocket, and headed for the ballpark. The Mets were at home against the Pirates, who were already guaranteed another losing season. With 17 games to go, the Mets were in first place, 2 games ahead of the Phillies, and primed for another choke in the stretch. Kyle had paid cash for 2 tickets sold by a broker recommended by a paralegal at the firm. As he made his way to Shea Stadium, he picked up his surveillance as it was picking up him. His seat was 15 rows behind the third base dugout. The night was hot. The Mets were in first. The place was packed. He timed his entrance perfectly and sat down just as the first pitch was thrown in the bottom of the first. To his right was a young boy holding a baseball glove and eating ice cream. To his left was a real fan with a Mets cap, Mets jersey, blue and orange sweatbands, even goofy Mets eyeglasses. Under the cap and behind the glasses was Joey Bernardo, who had spent his entire life in Pittsburgh and hated the Mets almost as much as he hated the Phillies.
"Do not acknowledge me," Kyle said as he watched the field.
"Don't worry. Right now I hate your guts, and I hate the Mets almost as much as I hate you."
"Thanks. I like the glasses."
"Can I take them off? I can't see a damn thing."
"No."
They were talking out of the corners of their mouths, just loud enough to hear each other. Shea was alive with every pitch, and there was little chance of being overheard. Joey took a sip of a tall beer.
"Are they really following you?"
"Oh yes, every day, everywhere."
"Do they know that you know?"
"I don't think so."
"But why?"
"Basic espionage tradecraft."
"Of course."
"Information is crucial. The more they watch and listen, the more they know about me. If they know what I eat, drink, wear, watch, listen to, and who I talk to and hang out with, and where I like to shop and browse and sneak away to, then they might one day be able to use it all to their advantage. Sounds pretty dull to you and me, but not to these guys."
More beer as Joey absorbed this. A ball bounced off the left field wall, scoring a run, and the crowd was on its feet. Kyle and Joey acted like all the other fans. When things had settled down, Kyle continued.
"For example, I found this wonderful little store in Midtown that sells all sorts of spy gadgets, tiny cameras, hidden mics, phone tapping devices, and some high-tech stuff that the military has left behind.
It's run by a couple of misfits who claim to be ex-CIA, but then people who are really ex-CIA don't talk about it. I found the store online, at the office, not at the apartment, and I've been there twice when I was able to shake surveillance. I might need the store one day, but if the goons knew I had discovered the place, they would really be interested.
This is too weird.
A lady in front of Joey turned around and offered a curious glance. They did not speak for the rest of the first inning.
How about the report on Elaine?
Joey whispered. It worries me.
So what's next?
I think you should go see her.
No way.
It's easy. Just bump into her and see what happens.
Right. Drive to Scranton, a town I can't recall seeing in the past 10 years. Somehow find her, recognize her, assume she'll recognize me, then what? Have a friendly little chat about the last time we were together? Have a laugh for old time's sake? Hell, Kyle, she accused me of rape.
Shh, Kyle hissed softly. The word rape sort of hung in the thick air, but no one reacted to it.
Sorry,
Joey whispered, and they watched the game for a long time.
A ferocious argument erupted at first base after a close call, and all 50,000 fans had an opinion. In the roar, Kyle said,
It would be an interesting meeting, to see how she reacts. Will she talk to you? Is she bitter, angry, full of vengeance? You take the high road and say that the encounter has always troubled you, that you want to talk about it. See if she'll meet you for a drink and a serious conversation. You're not going to admit anything. You just want to see how she feels. Maybe you want closure. What's there to lose?
What if she recognizes me, pulls out a gun, and bam?
I'll take care of Blair.
Kyle managed this with a grin, though the thought of spending any more time with Joey's girl was not pleasant.
Thanks. She's pregnant, you know. Thanks for asking.
Why is she pregnant?
Basic biology, but we're both surprised.
Congratulations, Daddy.
Getting married is one thing, but I'm not so sure about this fatherhood business.
I thought her career was at full throttle.
Yep, me too. She said she was on the pill, but I don't know.
This was not a topic Kyle wanted to explore. The more they talked, the easier conversation became, and that was not wise. I'm going to the restroom, Kyle said.
Bring me a beer.
No. I don't know you, remember?
Come on, Kyle, you think someone here is watching you?
With binoculars, at least two of them. They followed me here, probably bought tickets from a scalper outside the gates, and now they're watching.
But why?
Basic surveillance, Joey. I'm a valuable asset, yet they don't trust me. You should read some spy novels.
That's your problem. Too much fiction.
Kyle took his time between innings. He visited the men's room, then bought a diet soda and peanuts. When he returned to his seat, he struck up a conversation with the kid on his right, a loyal Met fan who knew every player and all their stats. His father was in advertising, and Kyle managed to seem intrigued with that career. He cracked peanuts, scattered the hulls at his feet, and ignored Joey for a long time. Joey, still half-blinded by the oversized Met's eyeglasses, suffered in silence. The Pirates were down 4 runs after 4 innings, and he was ready to leave. Kyle eventually reshifted and began studying the scoreboard in center field.
Any word from Baxter? He said without moving his jaws.
Nothing. I think they've locked him in a cave.
I know the feeling. I've been in a dungeon all week.
I don't want to hear it. For the money they're paying you, no complaints.
Okay. They know that he's in rehab, and they probably know where he is, Kyle said as a long fly ball was caught on the warning track.
They?
The goons. Their leader told me last week that he's in rehab.
How often do you meet with this guy?
Too often.
Have you handed over any secrets?
Nope, I have not been compromised.
Joey sipped his beer, swallowed slowly, and with the cup in front of his mouth said,
If they know about Baxter, are they keeping tabs on me?
It's possible. Play it safe. Vary your movements. Be careful with all correspondence.
Oh, this is just great.
My apartment is full of cameras and mics. They come and go when they wish. I don't have an alarm system, don't want one, but I know when they've been there. Everything I do in my apartment is subject to being watched and recorded. But they don't know that I know, so I give them nothing of consequence.
So you're outsmarting these professional intelligence agents?
I think so.
Another long pause in the conversation as the pirates changed pitchers again.
What's the end game, Kyle?
I don't have one. I'm taking small, safe steps. Next, we make contact with a girl and see how bad things are there.
Pretty bad, I'd guess.
Let's see.
Kyle reached for his vibrating pocket and yanked out the firm phone. He scrolled down, found the message, and felt like cursing.
What is it? Joey asked, trying not to look at the phone.
It's a partner. He's got a project. Wants me at the office at 7 in the morning.
Tomorrow's Saturday, Kyle.
Just another day at the office.
Are these guys crazy?
No, just greedy.
During the 7th inning stretch, Kyle eased out of his seat and made his way to the gates. Joey stayed until the 8th, and finally he left as his beloved Pirates were losing their 90th game. Jeans were allowed on Saturdays and Sundays. The fact that there was a dress code for the weekend, however relaxed, said much about the practice of corporate law on Wall Street.
Why were they even there?
Kyle wore jeans, as did Dale, who looked spectacular in a pair of tight ones. Tim Reynolds wore starched khakis. All three were dazed at the reality of being in a small conference room on the 34th floor at 7 a.m. on the second Saturday of their fledgling careers. They joined four older associates, four young men Kyle had not had the pleasure of meeting or even seeing during his first 2 weeks on the job. Passing introductions were made, but only because they were expected. The partner who had called the meeting was nowhere to be seen. His name was Tobias Rowland, Toby behind his back, and of all the sizzling gossip Kyle had heard so far, the worst had been about Toby. Toby's stories were abundant, and very few were even remotely flattering. Yale undergrad, Columbia law, poor kid from a rough neighborhood with a gigantic chip on his shoulder. Brilliant, ruthless, conniving, he'd made partner in only 5 years. Primarily because he worked harder than the rest of the workaholics and never relaxed. His idea of time off was a 10-minute tryst with a secretary on the sofa in his office. Most secretaries were terrified of him, too frightened to complain or file suit. Some, though, found him sexy enough for a quick romp. For fun, he berated young associates, often cursing them in the foulest of language for the smallest of infractions. He intimidated the other partners because he was smarter and always better prepared. At the age of 44, he was the top producing, billing, litigator in the firm and had not lost a jury trial in 8 years. Toby was in demand by the in-house lawyers of many major corporations. A year earlier, Kyle had read and clipped an article in Fortune touting the greatness of Scully and Pershing's fanciest litigator. When Toby beckoned, you went running, albeit with a great deal of trepidation. In his place that morning was a senior associate named Bronson, who, as he explained without a trace of enthusiasm, was standing in for Mr. Rowland, who was just down the hall working on another aspect of the lawsuit at hand. He might pop in at any moment, and this prospect kept everyone wide awake. Their client was a major oil company that was about to be sued by a Dutch firm over some disputed reserves in the Gulf of Mexico. The lawsuit was expected to be filed in New Orleans, but Mr. Rowland had decided to file a preemptive lawsuit in New York. The plan was to file it first thing Monday morning. It was an ambush, a daring tactic that could backfire, the type of risky maneuver that Toby was famous for. After a few minutes of listening to a lawsuit described in terms reminiscent of the D-Day invasion, Kyle realized that his Saturday and Sunday were shot to hell and would be spent researching jurisdictional issues in the law library. He glanced at his firm phone, scrolled down through the emails, and something caught his eye. At 7:30 on a Saturday morning, the firm was sending an email to all lawyers announcing the resignation of Gavin Mead, a fourth-year associate in litigation. No details, no comments, nothing but a quiet and quick exit. Everybody has secrets, Benny said. How did he do it? Perhaps an anonymous package mailed to someone in human resources? Affidavits, police records, the works. Poor Mead, 10 years removed from his crime and hustling through the grind at $400,000 a year, when suddenly he gets a summons to a meeting with closed doors.
Bronson was rattling on about being the hub of a wooden wheel, with spokes running down and out to the seven associates below him, and several running upward to Mr. Rowland and the other litigation partners. At the hub, he, Bronson, would direct traffic between the big boys and the rookies. He would organize the work, supervise the research, and handle correspondence with the partners. Everything crossed his desk. Time was crucial. If word leaked, the Dutch firm and its lawyers might do all sorts of evil things. The nation's oil supply hung in the balance, perhaps even Western civilization. Off they went to the library. Chapter 18. After a series of phone calls that became more and more tense, a deal was finally reached. Dr. Boone and Uncle Wally acquiesced, but managed to keep one string attached. Baxter would leave early, but spend 3 nights in a halfway house in Reno before re-entry into the real world. 105 days after arriving sloppy drunk with a blood alcohol content of 0.28 and with significant residues of cocaine in his system, Baxter rode through the gates and left behind the safety of the Washoe retreat. He was squeaky clean and 10 pounds lighter, and not only had he kicked booze and drugs, he had also quit smoking. He was fit, tanned, and clear-headed, and thoroughly believed he had conquered his demons and would henceforth live the sober life. He was armed for battle with the teachings of Dr. Boone and the other counselors. He had confessed his sins and surrendered to a higher power, whatever and whoever that was. At the age of 25, he was beginning a new life, and Baxter was both proud and apprehensive, even frightened. As the miles passed, he found himself more uncomfortable. His confidence was rapidly disappearing. He had failed so many times in so many ways. It was a family tradition. Was it in his DNA? An orderly drove him from the clinic in the Nightingale Mountains into Reno, a 2-hour drive in which little was said. As they approached the city, they passed a splashy billboard advertising an imported beer in a cold green bottle. The slinky young woman holding it could entice any man to do almost anything. Fear hit Baxter harder. It consumed him, and beads of sweat lined his forehead. He wanted to turn around, to run back to the clinic, where there was no alcohol and no temptations. But he said nothing. Hope Village was in a rundown section of Reno. Abandoned buildings, cheap casinos, and bars. It was the domain of Brother Manny, the founder, pastor, and leader of Hope Village. He was waiting at the curb outside the church's front door when Baxter stepped onto the hot sidewalk. He grabbed Baxter's hand and shook it violently.
Mr. Tate, may I call you Baxter?
The question suggested its own answer. He was Baxter, not Mr. Tate.
Sure, Baxter said, his spine stiffened from this physical assault. I'm Brother Manny, he said, placing his thick left arm on Baxter's shoulder, completing a rather rough howdy-do. Welcome to Hope Village.
He was about 50, Hispanic, bronze skin, gray hair pulled back tightly into a long ponytail that fell to his waist, warm eyes, big toothy smile, a small scar beside his left nostril and a larger one on his right cheek. His face was adorned with a soft white goatee that had been pampered for many years.
Another escapee from Washoe Retreat, he said with a deep, melodious voice. How is the good Dr. Boone doing up there?
Fine, Baxter said. Brother Manny's nose was about 5 inches from his. Close contact obviously did not bother him, but it made Baxter uncomfortable.
He sends his regards. A fine man. Come, I'll show you around. We have you for just 3 nights, as I understand.
That's right. They began walking slowly. Brother Manny kept one arm across Baxter's shoulders. He was a large man, with a thick barrel chest, and he wore dungarees and a white linen shirt, 2 top buttons open, with a long tail left out so that it swept behind him. Sandals, no socks. The church had once belonged to an affluent white congregation that fled to the suburbs. As Baxter shuffled through the tour, he also got the backstory. Manny Lucera had found the lure during his second term in prison, armed robbery, the proceeds from which were meant to buy drugs for personal consumption, and upon his parole, he was led by the Spirit to Reno to start his ministry. 17 years ago, and the Lord had blessed him mightily. The church had grown and now housed a shelter for the homeless in the basement, a soup kitchen that fed anyone who showed up, a community center for the poor kids in the neighborhood, an intake center for women and children fleeing abusive men, and there were plans for an orphanage. The old buildings next door had been purchased and renovated. The complex was crawling with people, employees, volunteers, street people, and they almost bowed in deference when they saw Brother Manny. They parked themselves on a picnic table in the shade and sipped canned lemonade.
"What's your drug?" Manny asked.
"Coke, booze, but I didn't say no to anything," Baxter admitted. After 15 weeks of baring his soul to people who already knew everything, he did not hesitate to tell the truth.
"For how long?"
"Started slow when I was about 14. Picked up steam as I got older. I'm 25 now, so 11 years.
"Where are you from?"
"Pittsburgh, originally."
"Background?"
"Privileged."
Brother Manny issued the questions and absorbed the answers with such ease that after 15 minutes together, Baxter felt as though he could chat for hours and tell him everything.
"First rehab?"
"Second."
"I did every drug you can imagine, and some you've never heard of, for 20 years. I bought, sold, smuggled, and manufactured drugs. I got knifed 4 times, shot 3, and went to prison 2 for drugs. I lost my first wife and 2 children because of drugs and alcohol. I lost my chance for an education. I lost 8 years because of prison. I almost lost my life. I know all about addictions because I've been there. I'm a certified drug and alcohol counselor, and I work with addicts every day." "Are you an addict?"
"Yes."
"Bless you, brother. Do you know Christ?"
"I guess. My mother took me to church every Christmas."
Brother Manny smiled and slowly wiggled his large rear end off the table.
"Let me show you your room. It's not the Ritz, but it'll do."
The homeless shelter was a large basement room with a temporary partition dividing it, women on one side, men on the other. It was open, with rows of army surplus cots in neat lines.
"Most of these people work during the day. They're not bums," Brother Manny was saying. "They'll start drifting in around 6 p.m. Here's your room."
Near the showers, there were 2 small private rooms with nicer cots and portable fans. Brother Manny opened the door to one and said,
"You can have this one. It's for a supervisor. To get a private room, you must have a job, so you'll help with the dinner preparation. Then later, when everybody's tucked in, you'll help with security."
He uttered these definitive statements in such a way that any thought of protest was immediately cut off and out of the question. Baxter's world was spinning. He'd begun the day in the cushy confines of a 4-star rehab ranch, and done so with giddy thoughts of finally leaving. Now he was in the hot basement of an old church that was home to 52 of the poorest souls in America, and he was expected to live with them for the next 3 days, and to cook their meals and break up their fights. Baxter Tate, of the Pittsburgh Tate dynasty, bankers, blue bloods who lived in mansions handed down from one miserable generation to the next, proud and arrogant people who married into other similar clans, thus producing even shallower gene pools. How had he reached this point in his young life? Legally, he could leave any time he wanted. Hit the door, find a cab, never look back. There was no court order restraining him. Uncle Wally might be disappointed, but that would be the extent of Baxter's worries if he fled.
"Are you okay?"
Brother Manny asked.
"No."
It was refreshing to be so honest.
"Take a nap. You look pale."
He couldn't sleep because of the heat. After an hour, he sneaked away and found himself roaming downtown Reno. He had a late lunch in a diner, his first burger and fries in months. He had the money to get a hotel room for a day or two, and that plan consumed him as he zigzagged through the streets. He passed and repassed the casinos. He'd never been a gambler, but every casino had a bar, didn't it? Of course, the bars were off limits,
but he couldn't stomach the thought of returning to Hope Village, at least not now. At a blackjack table, he pulled out $5 $20 bills, got some green chips, and played the $5 game for a few minutes. An aging cocktail waitress swept by, asked what he wanted to drink.
"A bottle of water," he said without hesitation, then patted himself on the back.
The only other player at the table was a cowboy, black hat and all, with a bottle of beer in front of him. Baxter drank his water, played his hands, and occasionally glanced at the bottle of beer. It looked so harmless, so beautiful. When his chips had been taken by the dealer, he left the table and wandered around the casino floor. It was a dreadful place, sparsely filled with people who had no business being there, gambling with money they could not afford to lose. He walked by a sports bar, with wide screens showing old football games. The weekend's point spreads were posted. The bar was empty. He settled onto a stool and ordered water. What would Dr. Boone say about this? Not 6 hours into re-entry, and he was already at a bar. "Relax, Dr. Boone. It's just water. If I can resist the urge here at Ground Zero, then the next place will be easy." He sipped water and occasionally glanced at the rows of liquor bottles. Why were there so many different shapes and sizes? So many different types of spirits? One entire row was taken by flavored vodkas, delicious liquids he had consumed by the barrel back in the days when he was a drunk. Thank God those days were over. In the distance, across the floor somewhere, a siren squealed and bells erupted. A lucky slot player had hit a jackpot, and the racket was to remind everyone just how easy it was to win. The bartender filled a glass with a draft beer, then slammed it in front of Baxter. "On the house," he proclaimed. "Super slot jackpot!" Free drinks for everyone at the bar, which was nobody but Baxter. He almost said, "Hey, pal, take it away. I don't drink anymore." But the bartender was gone. Plus, it would sound silly. How many non-drinkers sidle up to a casino bar at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? The glass was frosty, the beer ice cold. It was darker in color, and Baxter looked at the tap. Nevada Pale Ale. One he'd never tried. His mouth was dry, so he sipped water. For 105 days, he'd been hammered by Dr. Boone and the other pros at Washoe Retreat into believing that another drink would eventually lead him back to his addictions. He'd watched and listened as other patients, or guests as they were called, struggled through detox and told their stories of repeated failures. "Don't ever be fooled," they warned repeatedly. "You cannot handle a single drink. Total abstinence is required." Maybe so. Small bubbles of water formed on the glass and began to run down to the napkin under it. He was 25 years old, and he never truly believed, not even in his purest moment back at Washoe, that he would live the rest of his life without a drink. Somewhere deep down in his soul, he knew he could find the willpower to have a drink, maybe a couple, then stop for the night before things got out of hand. If he planned to drink, why not start now? The last time, he tortured himself for 14 days before breaking down. For 2 weeks, he lied to himself, and especially to his friends, about loving the life of sobriety, and every single moment he craved a drink. Why go through the misery again? The beer was getting warm. He heard the voices of his counselors. He remembered the tears and confessions of the other guests. He heard himself proclaim the gospel of the sober. "I am an alcoholic, weak and powerless, in need of strength from a higher being." And they were weak, those other losers back at Washoe Retreat. But not Baxter. He could handle a few drinks because he was stronger. He rationalized that he would, under no circumstances, succumb to the romance and horror of cocaine. Nor would he indulge in hard liquor. Just a little beer, occasionally. And he might get serious about wine. No big deal. Still, he could not make himself reach forward and touch the glass. It was 18 inches away, well within his grasp, just standing there like a coiled rattler ready to kill. Then it was a luscious treat that delivered a pleasant buzz. Back and forth, back and forth. Evil versus good.
You need to make new friends,
Dr. Boone had said repeatedly. And you can't go back to your old haunts. Find some new places, new friends, new challenges, a different place to live.
Well, how about this, Dr. Boone? Sitting here for the very first time in a run-down Reno casino he couldn't remember the name of. Never been here before? Ha ha. Both hands were free. And at some point, Baxter realized his right hand was shaking slightly, and his breathing was labored and heavy.
You okay, buddy? The bartender asked as he walked by.
Yes. No. Baxter nodded something but couldn't speak. His eyes were locked on the glass of beer. Where was he? What was he doing? 6 hours after leaving rehab, he was in a bar brawling with himself over whether he should take another drink. He was already a loser. Look where he was.
With his left hand, he reached forward, touched the glass, then slid it slowly toward him. He stopped when it was 6 inches away. He could smell the barley and hops. The glass was still cold, or cold enough. The war shifted from good versus evil to run versus stay. He almost managed to shove himself away from the bar and sprint back through the slots to the front door. Almost. Oddly, it was Keefe who helped him make the decision. Keefe was his best friend at Washoe, and Keefe was from a wealthy family that was paying for the third rehab. The first two tanked when Keefe convinced himself that a little pot was harmless. Baxter whispered to himself, "If I drink this beer now, and if things turn out badly, I can always go back to Washoe, and with two failures, I'll be convinced that total abstinence is required. Just like Keefe. But right now, I really want this beer."
With both hands, he clasped the glass, raised it slowly, sniffing as it grew closer. He smiled when the cold glass touched his lips. The first sip of Nevada Pale Ale was the most magnificent nectar he'd ever tasted. He savored it, eyes closed, face serene. From over his right shoulder, someone yelled loudly,
"There you are, Baxter!"
He almost choked, and he almost dropped the glass. He jerked around, and there was Brother Manny, closing fast and obviously not happy.
"What are you doing?"
he demanded as he lowered a heavy hand on Baxter's shoulder and seemed ready to trade punches. Baxter wasn't sure what he was doing. He was drinking a beer, one that was definitely off limits, but he was so horrified at that moment he couldn't speak. Brother Manny delicately took the glass and slid it down the bar.
"Get rid of this," he growled at the bartender.
Then he sat on the stool next to Baxter and moved in low until his nose was once again 5 inches away.
"Listen to me, son," he said in a soft voice. "I cannot make you leave this place right now. That is your decision. But if you want me to help you, then say so. I'll get you out of here, take you back to my church, make some coffee, and we'll tell some stories."
Baxter's shoulders sagged and his chin dropped. The ale was still attacking his taste buds.
"This could be the most important decision of your life," Brother Manny said. "Right now, at this moment, stay or go. If you stay, you'll be dead in 5 years. If you want to go, then say so, and we'll leave together."
Baxter closed his eyes and said,
"I'm so weak."
"Yes, but I'm not. Let me get you out of here."
"Please."
Brother Manny practically lifted him off the stool, then put a thick arm around his shoulders. They slowly made their way past the slot machines and empty roulette wheels, and they were almost to the front door when Brother Manny realized that Baxter was crying. The tears made him smile. An addict must hit the bottom before he starts his climb. The pastor's office was a large, cluttered room next to the sanctuary. The secretary, Brother Manny's wife, brought them a pot of strong coffee and two mismatched mugs. Baxter sat low in an old leather sofa and sipped furiously, as if he could rinse away the taste of the beer. The tears had stopped, for now. Brother Manny sat close by on a wooden rocker, and as he talked, he moved slowly back and forth.
"I was in prison in California," he was saying. "The second time around, in a gang,
doing worse stuff on the inside than we did on the streets. I got careless one day, got away from my turf, and the rival gang jumped me. Woke up in the prison hospital with broken bones and cuts and such. Cracked skull,